court. Can you see it, please? Case number 10-5043. Matthew Bush, Nebraska Appellant, versus Hillary Rodham Clinton, Secretary of State and Official Facts. Mr. Alderman for Appellant, Mr. Beck,
good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. With me is Bill Aramone, who was with me on the briefs as well. Your Honor, while it wasn't the only mistake that the district court made, the most important was disregarding the threat that Wunder made to McGrath, the threat of retaliation that he actually executed on. The court disregarded that threat under the theory that the plaintiff's statement alone couldn't support the finding of retaliatory intent. But that was simply incorrect. And there are several cases from this court, including George v. Levitt and Desmond v. McCasey, that hold that a plaintiff's own statements can support such a finding and can create material disputes of fact. Once you accept that the threat was made, that then poisons every explanation that Wunder gave after the threat was issued, because a reasonable jury could conclude that the negative EER that ended up ending Mr. McGrath's career was motivated as a result of the threat, instead of any valid concerns about Mr. McGrath's performance.
What is the evidence that Mr. McGrath had a reasonable basis for thinking that Mr. Wunder was discriminating against the employee based on her race?
The evidence of that, Your Honor, is Wunder's own statement that he brought up Ms. Montgomery's limitations resulting from her disability.
Where is that? Can you tell me the page?
It's 401 of the Joint Appendix. That's Mr. Wunder's EEO statement. So that's without the benefit of cross-examination. Mr. Wunder actually offered up the fact that he raised Ms. Montgomery's limitations.
I'm sorry, it's a long page. Can you refer to me where on page it is? Page, you're talking about JA 401, right?
Line 2-5, Your Honor. Starting at line 3, Wunder says, I noted to him that I had received relatively little email communication from Ms. Montgomery about her programs and saw little written reporting generated by her.
That doesn't sound discriminatory in any way. I assume you're going to tell me something where Wunder says something discriminatory.
Well, that relates to Ms. Montgomery's disability. She had Parkinson's. It was difficult for her to write.
Is there any place where Mr. Wunder says, I don't like her because she has Parkinson's, I don't like her because she's black, I don't like her because she's a woman, anything like that?
Less direct than that, but yes.
Show me your best evidence.
Okay. Mr. Wunder tells McGrath that the EEO regulations do not require him to keep someone who is limited by their disabilities.
Show me.
That's footnote 10 of the appellant's.
I don't want your brief.
Of the appellee's brief.
I don't want the brief. I want to see the place in the record.
Should be at 399, Your Honor. Lines 7-8.
Thank you. 399?
Sorry, Your Honor. It's line 13.
At JA 399?
Yes, Your Honor.
And whose statement am I reading here?
This is Mr. Wunder's statement, where he states, I noted that EEO regulations do not require that an employee be kept in the same position if that employee cannot perform at an acceptable level.
That's a correct statement of the law, isn't it?
That is a correct statement of the law.
How could you determine that somebody's acting discriminatory?
Well, Your Honor, Mr. Montgomery is demanding that Mr. McGrath take action against Ms. Montgomery because of her poor performance. McGrath then indicates, we can't take action against her. She adds diversity. She's the only African American here. She has a disability, and her disability doesn't limit any of her ability to perform her work. Yeah. At that point in time, Wonder then says, yeah, but those EEO regulations don't require you to keep somebody.
They don't require you if the person cannot perform at an acceptable level after compensatory steps have been taken, all of which is true.
That is a true
statement. If a person accurately states the law and acts in conformance with the law, that doesn't make them discriminatory. Here you have the chance to have your own witness say the most discriminating thing that the supervisor said, and the best he can say is that the supervisor told me what the law correctly states.
Your Honor, what it demonstrates is that there was a discussion and an argument about her disabilities, whether her disability permitted her to do her work, which can form the basis for McGrath to reasonably believe that his supervisor was trying to get rid of Montgomery because of her disability.
I'm just asking where the reasonable belief part comes. If your supervisor tells you, look, this is what the law says. A person who's disabled cannot be terminated unless they can't, with adequate compensatory steps, perform their work. How does that lead to the reasonable belief that your supervisor is discriminating?
It's the context of that conversation, Your Honor.
But
it's the context. Mr. McGrath is telling Wonder that there is no problem here. And Wonder is pushing back, saying, you don't have to keep her. And if you don't start to document her poor performance, it's going to show up on your record.
So these two pages are the best evidence you have then, JA 399 and JA 401?
There may be other discussion in the briefs, but I believe that those are the most direct evidence that this conversation happened and that it involved discussion of her disability.
Okay. And no discussion of race or gender?
McGrath did discuss her race and said, I think that taking action against her would be unlawful because of her race and her disability.
Right, but did
Wonder... He may have also mentioned age.
Did Wonder ever say anything about that? Wonder's an employer, right?
That's right. But I think it would be pretty surprising if someone of Mr. Wonder's level would say, hey, you need to take care of her because she's black and she's disabled. Let's get rid of her. I think that would be pretty shocking and surprising.
But in the absence of those statements, what's the evidence that he did discriminate based on race or gender?
Well, there is additional evidence of certainly race-based discrimination.
What's that evidence?
Well, you have bias shown towards the white subordinates.
Where's the evidence of bias towards the whites?
It's in denial of leave requests towards African Americans.
While one denial of a leave request towards the same employee, right? Is there anybody else? Is there anything else?
No, Your Honor. Not in terms of leave requests.
Uh-huh.
In addition, there's in the record, there's statements about preferential assignments. There's also an environment.
Whose statements are those?
I believe those are Mr. McGrath's.
And he would know. This particular employee said she didn't notice that.
While that's true, there may have been behind-the-scenes conversations that employee wasn't aware of.
Uh-huh. Okay.
She was also the only African American at that level in the agency, which is something.
Is there any evidence about preferential assignments from some of the assistants whom Mr. McGrath supervised?
I believe that there was some discussion about that, but I don't have a precise citation for you on that point. You also have just an environment that seemed to instill racial animus. You had the white employees saying that Mr. McGrath acted black. And Wonder himself actually indicated that there were problems between the races under his supervision in his testimony. So, again, once you accept that the threat was made, then all of the explanations after that point are put into doubt, and a reasonable jury could conclude that the real reason was retaliation. In addition, you also have the fact that Mr. McGrath went to the EEO, or someone that he thought was an EEO counselor, before the time that this negative EER was actually issued.
So he gets the benefit of that, where he mistakenly goes to someone who's simply a personnel person? Was Mrs. Hill's job title or area of responsibility?
I don't know what her particular job title or area of responsibility was. I know that she held herself out as an EEO representative.
And that I'll find in the record?
Yes, Your Honor. That's at the end of our reply brief, the last few pages of the reply. I see that I'm beyond...
What's the evidence that he, Wonder, knows about that?
Well, the evidence of that is that as soon as Mr. McGrath complained to Ms. Hill, Wonder started locking him out of discussions that involved personnel. Mr. McGrath also tried to pursue internal avenues.
Is there any evidence that he knew?
There's no direct
evidence. There's two possible explanations. One, that was just the time when he did these things, and two, he did it because he knew. There's no evidence, internal, documentary?
No, it would be inferential, Your Honor. Mr. McGrath also spoke to Mr. Wonder's supervisor at the time, not Mr. Sexton, it was Mr. Sexton's replacement, about his concerns, and the EEO, the executive officer of that. So he spoke to Mr. Wonder's supervisors, and it's reasonable to believe that those supervisors then spoke to Wonder about the issue. If there are no further questions, I would like to be able to come back for a rebuttal.
Yeah.
Thank you, Your Honors.
All right, counsel for appellee.
May it please the court, Brian Hudak from the U.S. Attorney's Office on behalf of the appellee, the Secretary of State. State asks that this court affirm the judgment of the district court, which granted summary judgment in state's favor on plaintiff's remaining retaliation-based claims concerning his 2002 performance evaluation called an EER. State believes this case closely parallels that confronted by the court in Waterhouse. In Waterhouse, as here, McGrath does not dispute the events underlying his unsatisfactory performance evaluation. Instead, McGrath offers arguments that notwithstanding those failures, state should not have given him an unsatisfactory EER because there were extenuating circumstances, excuses for his deficiencies, and there were some positive attributes to his performance. This is not enough. McGrath must come forward after a legitimate non-retaliatory reason has been offered and meaningfully challenge that reason. As the Tenth Circuit has put it, McGrath must show such weaknesses, implausibilities, inconsistencies, incoherencies, or contradictions in state's proffered reasons such that a reasonable fact finder could rationally find them unworthy of credence. Here, for example, McGrath does not contest that the Billy Taylor ceremony was his responsibility and that he did not finish the tasks associated with that ceremony before he left for leave.
But he offers an explanation.
He offers an explanation, but the explanation is that I didn't know it was going to occur, not that it wasn't my responsibility and I didn't finish it. And he told his supervisor before he left for leave, when he was directly asked by Mr. Wonder, do you have any pending projects that I should be aware of? And he said no.
So it was not communicative.
Not communicative. And if you read the evaluation, those are the type of criticisms that Wonder puts in here, and they're accurate. Other undisputed performance deficiencies include not responding to Wonder's email, urgent email, after the Billy Taylor ceremony saying, Matt, is there any other activities, pending projects like this that I need to be aware of when you're gone for a month? And Mr. McGrath didn't respond. And Mr. McGrath not only didn't respond, he didn't come to Wonder after he returned to the office and say, I'm sorry about this, or address anything regarding the Billy Taylor ceremony. Further, it's undisputed that McGrath did not hold weekly staff meetings, despite being directed by Wonder in March to hold those.
He had an explanation for that.
He had an explanation?
Because Mueller, or Mueller, disrupted the meetings so they were non-productive, so he was meeting one-on-one.
He said that early on, but then in March, when Wonder said, I want you to have these regular staff meetings, he didn't recommence them. There was a direct instruction. It's a written instruction, and it was a verbal instruction. He didn't recommence them. It's also undisputed that Wunder asked him to talk to representatives of the Korean embassy about a cultural program. McGrath does not dispute that he did.
I thought that the Korean issue was post the EER.
I believe the record establishes that it was the only evidence in the record as far as a date for that interaction is April 7th. Okay. Wunder doesn't, McGrath, when asked when that occurred, he said, I don't know, it was towards the tail end of my time in ECA, and his time in ECA ended in May or June following his EER in April. It's also undisputed that fully 50% of the program officers that he supervised complained to Wunder about the supervision and guidance they were receiving. At the end of the day, these are undisputed, and McGrath needs to come forward with some meaningful challenge to these reasons to show that they're inaccurate, inconsistent, contradictory, implausible, or weak, such that to tackle the legitimate non-retaliatory reason in this case. He doesn't do so. As far as his participation-based claims, there is no evidence that Wunder or Sexton knew about his EEO activity, if you can call going to the Human Resources Division EEO activity, in this case, before they issued the EER.
Opposing counsel said there was something about Sexton. I didn't quite catch that. What was that?
McGrath's testimony is that he went to Mr. Hart, who replaced Mr. Sexton as of April of that year. He went to Mr. Hart and told him about it, but not Mr. Sexton and not Mr. McGrath. Further, there is, as far as the review statement, Sexton's review statement, there's no evidence in the record that Sexton knew about McGrath's supposed opposition clause activity or the participation-based activity.
Did Hart have to sign off on
Hart did not. Sexton was the second-line supervisor for a majority of the time, and thus Human Resources directed that Sexton be the one to provide the review statement. Okay. There's no further questions, Your Honors. We ask that the judgment of the district court be affirmed. Thank you.
Would you agree with appellant that it was error for the district court to rely on the prior performance evaluations?
Your Honor, I don't think that he relied on them as far as the basis for the 2002 EER.
I might agree with you, but he does include it in his opinion.
He includes it because, as the Tenth Circuit has noted, if there is an inconsistency in performance, say a person is performing excellent for 10 years and then all of a sudden falls off the ledge, that may be some inference that something may be afoot. But given that he had similar criticisms in the performance evaluations that he had immediately prior to joining ECA, it doesn't create that inconsistency. It's knocking down the issue that this is somehow coming out of the blue, that he did not exhibit this conduct in the past.
I think this circuit has taken a slightly stronger stance on this issue than that it is error to rely on that.
But again, I don't believe he was relying on it for the basis of the EER. That's not the legitimate non-retaliatory reason. It's saying that this retaliatory reason, non-retaliatory reason in light of other events, just doesn't give rise to some sort of inference of inconsistency.
Would you, along the same lines of opening the question, do you agree that it was error for the district court to say that statements, the defendant's, the employer's statements alone about what happened would be insufficient for a reasonable jury to believe?
I don't believe he said that, Your Honor. I believe what he did was, as appropriate, take McGrath's story in the light most favorable to him. But his story in the light most favorable to him does not meaningfully challenge the undisputed performance deficiencies that he had during his time at ECA.
The district court says the plaintiff's only evidence showing Wunder or anyone requested Mrs. Montgomery's performance be reviewed for the purpose of terminating her employment are his own allegations, and this is insufficient to rebut his employer's legitimate reasons for his negative evaluation reports and involuntary curtailment. That's at 145.
Yes, Your Honor, and I think that's slightly different. It's not he's not rejecting it that he's not believing it. He is saying that it's insufficient to overcome the legitimate non-retaliatory reason, because that alone does not challenge in any meaningful way the events underlying the unsatisfactory performance evaluation.
I was also a little puzzled about the discussion. I understand the discussion in the brief about mixed motive. The discussion about direct evidence puzzles me. You seem to be suggesting that there is some distinction between McDonnell Douglas and direct evidence, but classic descriptions of McDonnell Douglas include both. That is, you add up all the direct evidence and you add up the circumstantial evidence created by the burden shifting of McDonnell Douglas. Somebody doesn't have to elect between direct evidence and burden shifting if they have both, do they?
Well, Your Honor, there is some precedent from the Supreme Court in Trans World that said that the McDonnell Douglas framework, burden shifting framework, is irrelevant where there is direct evidence.
Well, that's true, but we're going in sort of in the other direction here, right? If they have direct evidence, then they don't have to shift the burdens. If somebody says, I'm firing you because you're black,
right,
that's sufficient. There doesn't have to be any. On the other hand, if you have a challenge to proffered explanations for being fired, which you show are pretext, and you also have direct evidence, you're certainly permitted to put in both, aren't you?
Sure. Okay. But I don't think there's...
Your position is there isn't any direct evidence here. I understand that.
Yes. And also, I think at the end of the day, in the appellant's reply, appellant conceded that this is a Brady case, that this is... We are looking at this case under Brady, not under some Trans World and progeny standard that may have been developed in the case law.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Counsel for appellant, we'll give you a couple of minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Two, I think, very important points. The performance criticisms are all in dispute. Not only are they disputed factually, but the timing that they're brought up raises questions about them. For example, Mr. Hudak just referenced failure to conduct meetings, failure to communicate with people, all this. But Mr. Wonder says that prior to February 20th, 2002, he didn't have a problem with Mr. McGrath's communications, his progress on his reports, his working with his subordinates. So all of these problems, so-called problems, come up after February 20th. But by March 8th, Wonder has already decided that McGrath is gone, voluntarily or involuntarily. So anything that happens after March 8th is irrelevant. It's a foregone conclusion that McGrath is gone. And that's in 413 of the joint appendix, Mr. Wonder's concession that he didn't have any problems with McGrath before February 20th. So that puts into doubt just about every explanation that's put in the EER, because they all focus on communications and supervisory leadership and things like this. And if you take a look closely at the EER, most of those criticisms are broad brush, conclusory criticisms about recoiling from leadership and being reclusive. He doesn't put dates or projects that the McGrath failed on, except for the Billy Taylor incident, which is in dispute. Wonder says that McGrath didn't give him a memo about Billy Taylor, but the record clearly shows that he did, that he wrote a memo about the Billy Taylor event. Another point that Your Honors were just, I think, referring to is the court's errors in considering these external and, I would say, irrelevant factors like the prior EERs and also the post, the after-the-fact concessions that Wonder gave to Montgomery, the speech recognition software. These things happened after Montgomery met with Wonder, with her union representative, where she confronted Wonder about his desire to terminate her. And so they're not relevant to this. But the court, while the court says that it didn't use these things to make a credibility decision, it actually says, this, and this is at the joint appendix 12A.
Does it really matter? I mean, our review is de novo. So whatever
true
errors the district court may or may not have committed really doesn't make any difference, does it?
That's true, Your Honor. That's true. But it does show the importance that the court put on these irrelevant things. And also, if you pay attention to the appellee's brief, the importance that the appellee puts on these things, they devote pages to McGrath's prior performance, which, with the exception of 1 year, was outstanding. And if you take a look at the EER from 2001, it indicates that McGrath has done a complete rebound with respect to supervisory skills.
So going into
2002, he's on a high.
Were you making an argument that the treatment, that the evaluations were inconsistent with his prior evaluations?
No, Your Honor. We're saying that the prior evaluations...
Did you make an argument that he had good evaluations, and then all of a sudden, after he started complaining in this new job, he was given a lower evaluation?
I actually don't know if that argument was made below. We didn't represent Mr. McGrath at the summary judgment.
So you wouldn't rely in any way then on any previous evidence of good performance by...
That's right. And there's no indication...
And you don't rely on any evidence of good performance afterwards either?
No, Your Honor. Okay. It's irrelevant. It's also irrelevant because Wunder never considered those prior EERs. So he wasn't basing his opinion on the prior EERs, which is what the agency would... makes it appear happen in this case. Thank you very much. I would commend pages 9 through 21 of our final reply brief, which goes into the details about the disputes over the performance criticisms and when they were raised and when they weren't raised. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you. We'll take the case under advisement.